The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Professor Timothy Snyder. He's the Levin Professor of History at Yale, and he's got a new book out. It's called On Freedom. Welcome to the program, sir.
Very glad to be with you.
You're kind of coming back to your home turf here in the near future. I understand that you grew up in Centerville.
That's right. I did. I grew up in Centerville, went to Centerville Public Schools, and was very familiar with Yellow Springs. And yours was the public radio station, which we often listened to.
Well, we love hearing that. Well, this is quite a book on freedom, and it follows up a much smaller book called On Tyranny. But these are big subjects, big issues, and one of the things that came through to me that I think we need to talk about is negative and positive freedom and how we differentiate those and how most Americans are probably experiencing negative freedom.
Yeah. So this is – On Freedom is a book about what freedom really is and about once we know that, how we would then try to govern ourselves. And it starts from what I think we get wrong. So I think we're right as a people to talk about freedom, but I think we talk about it in the wrong way. We talk about it as though it were only a matter of getting rid of the bad guy, knocking down the wall, shrinking the government. So that's what negative freedom means. It means I am against something. Something's holding me back. And sometimes something really is holding you back, and sometimes it's important to rebel, and sometimes you have to hold your own. But at the same time, the important thing really is the you. A wall is not a barrier unless a person's on the other side of it. And we have to ask the question of what it means for the person to be free. And so if you think about it that way, the freedom from things, the negative freedom, is really just the first step to the freedom to things, the freedom to become the person that you want to become, which is what positive freedom means. Positive freedom is about you. It's about the things you really care about, the things you really love, the things you really want to do, all the things that are true about you, all the things you truly value, and how you can make those things real in the world along with other people. That's what positive freedom is about. And if you think about freedom in terms of becoming yourself, becoming the person you want to be, then you recognize that that's not really possible just by rebelling or knocking things down. You have to build things. You have to build schools. You have to build roads. Nobody's going to grow up on their own, from an infant to an adult and become free without some kind of cooperation. And that cooperation, the right kind of cooperation, would be a good government. So freedom's positive because it's about what we want to be, but it's also positive in that it requires cooperation for us to get to freedom.
Unfortunately, most of the last 40-some years, we've been hearing about how bad government is. But without government, how do we have freedom?
We can't. I mean, unfortunately, it's a typically American but very childish misunderstanding to think that all you have to do is make the government smaller. It doesn't work if you make the government smaller. Other things just get bigger, like, for example, our Silicon Valley oligarchs, who are some of the people who tell us most that government has to be smaller. There is no, if power pours a vacuum, you can't just clear away government and imagine we're all going to be free. And the people who tell us that story are generally people who want us to be unfree, right? So the way to solve this problem is to ask what freedom really is. If freedom is about you becoming the person you want to be and me becoming the person I want to be, then we have to ask, well, what are the things we do together to make that so? And those have to involve roads, schools, childcare, pensions, healthcare. It has to involve stuff that we can only do together. And we all know this at some level. We just sometimes forget it. And so if you think about it that way, then you realize that there is no clash between freedom and government. That is made up. It's an easy answer, and it's wrong. What you have to do is you have to legitimate government by way of freedom. You have to say, well, the reason why we want these roads is we want our kids to be able to have the American dream. The reason why we want these public universities is we want our kids to have the American dream. The reason why government does stuff is so that Americans can be free. And so not everything government does is good, and government shouldn't be allowed to do everything, but it should be there to do the things which allow us to be free. And so this American thing where we were told it's pounded into our heads that we're choosing between freedom and government, that's just incorrect. If we're free people, then we should be able to build the right kind of government, which allows us to spread freedom across the country and down to the next generations.
Why do we treat each other like objects?
We shouldn't, should we? I think treating somebody else like an object is kind of the first step toward treating yourself as one. Like, what's special about us is that we don't entirely obey the laws of physics. We, you know, if you care about a value, you know, a little tiny thing like punctuality, like being on time, you know, that's you imposing something on the world that wasn't there before. You calling me at 11:59 was you, you know, following the value of punctuality. And then there are more important values like loyalty or honesty or grace or beauty or friendship. And these are the things which make us special. These are the things which make us not objects. But it's true of, if it's true of me, it's true of you. If it's true of one person, it's true of every person. And the funny thing is that we can only really become these people by recognizing others as being not objects, right? The moment we see them as objects, we're gonna fail to have the kinds of relationships where we can build up a society of free people. And maybe even more deeply, the moment we see them as objects, we can't really see ourselves. And I think this is a kind of a basic way where Americans go wrong about freedom. Like, we think we're always right, and nobody's always right. And freedom is not about always being right. If we have to be able to see ourselves the way we are to be free, because if we don't, we're going to follow the people who see our weaknesses. And the only way to see ourselves, the only way to understand our own weaknesses, is to listen to other people, to not treat them as objects, to treat them as fellow human beings, and to listen to them. So there's a funny way, like, it's not just a practical matter. It also goes very deep, personally, psychologically, philosophically. You can't really be free unless you recognize that other people aren't objects. It's tempting to treat them as objects. It might seem fun. It might seem simple, but you're going to end up not being free if you go down that route.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Professor Timothy Snyder. His new book is On Freedom. You take us through this and various steps in getting into positive freedom. And one thing that really came through to me is that if we don't feel empathy towards others, we'll never be free. And I know this is a very positive book, but we're looking at the calendar and we're seeing that it's quite possible that our freedom could really be curtailed in the near future. I know this isn't a book about a certain person, but this person I'm thinking of doesn't seem to have a whole lot of empathy. If anything, he's the hero of negative freedom.
Yeah, I mean, the book is meant to be hopeful, because I do think freedom is the right idea, and we've just got it wrong. And I do believe that people can get ideas right, and I do believe that if we get ideas right, in particular this idea right, it can get this country around a corner. And that's why I wrote the book. But it's not that it's easy. And it's not that everybody has the right ideas now. And it's not that other kinds of politics don't have attractions. Of course, it's attractive to believe that you don't have to care about the facts because one person is always right. And of course, it's attractive to believe in a story about how your guy never loses. You know, that stuff is attractive. If it weren't attractive, freedom would be easy, which it's not. And so, you know, the person you're talking about, Donald Trump, it's not a book about him, but he does figure in the book because, as you say, he's an example of where negative freedom gets you. If you just inherit $200 million from your father and you just think that the world is all about making sure that, you know, you can die in comfort in the White House, then this is where you end up. And the problem is that when we take, the problem is, you know, not so much him, the problem is when we take that as a model. Because if each of us behaves that way, and each of us thinks that freedom is just about selfishness and ignoring other people, and doing, you know, doing the greedy thing at every opportunity, then we're not going to have a country, right? It's not just that we're not going to be free people. The country can't hold together on that basis, and it won't.
You are listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I've been joined by Professor Timothy Snyder, and he's going to be swinging through our state of Ohio, his home state, this week. He's got a number of events and some in our region I need to inform you about. This coming Thursday, October 17th, he will be at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Cincinnati at 7 o'clock that evening for a reading and a signing. That's 2682 Madison Road in Cincinnati. And then the following day, the big event of his swing through Southwest Ohio, he will be at the Murphy Theater in Wilmington, 7 o'clock Friday night, October 18th. That's 50 West Main Street. This is a ticketed event. You can get information. There's a lot of information on this. Go to the website, themurphytheater.org. The Murphy Theater, that's spelled theater has an R-E at the end of it, themurphytheater.org, for ticket information on this event with Professor Snyder. Once again, that's Friday, this coming Friday, October 18th, at the Murphy Theater in Wilmington, 50 West Main Street. Then on October 20th, that is Sunday, he will be in Columbus, 3 o'clock that afternoon at the Book Loft of the Bexley Public Library, 2411 East Main Street. And that's Columbus, Ohio, Bexley Public Library. Bexley, Ohio, I would say, to be more specific. October 20th, Sunday, 3 o'clock that afternoon. So depending upon what area is in better proximity to your location, once again, we have those events, Thursday, October 17th, Joseph Beth in Cincinnati, Friday, October 18th, the Murphy Theater in Wilmington, and Sunday, October 20th, Bexley Public Library in Columbus area. And we'll continue our conversation right after this. The Book Nook continues on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. I've been joined on the program by Professor Timothy Snyder. His new book is On Freedom. We like to think of ourselves as being so smart, and we're watching as things are falling apart with our climate. I watched the recent debate between Trump and Harris, and one of the first questions I would have asked would have been about climate change. Instead, they saved it for last, and he completely ignored and avoided the question. And we're looking at the calendars, and we're seeing that we need to do stuff to be creative, to get us past this somehow, to be free, to keep living.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you completely. And I dwell on this in the book. I mean, in the book, the book starts with defining freedom and ends with defining government. But along the way, I have these five forms, as you know, and one of them is factuality. And a key example of factuality is that. It's the world itself, the basic truths about the world, how the world works, how photosynthesis works, how emitting carbon dioxide and other gases changes the atmosphere. I mean, in order to be free, you have to know things. You have to see the world for what it is in order to change it. And if you choose not to know things, you're choosing not to be free. And in this case, if we choose not to know what burning fossil fuels has done for the last couple hundred years, then we're choosing extinction. We're choosing impoverishment. We're choosing disaster. And that's the wrong choice, right? Like, the right choice is to say, okay, we have ways of knowing the world. Science is one of those ways. Here's a problem. And this problem could be solved by technology. And this is the thing which is frustrating, because it's not just that climate change is terrible. It's that the solutions to climate change, would create a much better world. Like, a lot of things are like this. You know, we're, the status quo is untenable. Things could get a lot worse, or they could get a lot better. It's going to be one or the other. But if we solve climate change, like if we had more solar and wind and hydro, and if we turned the corner on fusion, if we had those things, then a lot of other good things would follow. Those energy sources can't be held as monopolies, right? So we wouldn't have wealthy lobbyists warping the politics. So you'd get all kinds of good side effects and positive feedbacks if we were able to address climate. And the thing is, climate change, like, technologically, we can handle it. We could do it technologically. The problem is not the technology. The problem is us. The problem is our inability to see the world the way it is. And that really is a challenge for freedom, right? Like, you're not free because you turn away from reality. You're not free because you turn away from other people. You're free because you can listen to other people and you can think about reality and create tools so that that reality can be altered in such a way that things will go better. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the kind of freedom I'm trying to push through.
Professor Timothy Snyder joins us. His book is On Freedom. Yes, we have the technology, and we could do good with it. We should, we must, and yet we spend all this time on technology that imprisons us, that turns us into robots and zombies and puts us in vacuums. And let's talk about the role of our screens and social media in all this.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to start, I think we've really over-dignified the social media platforms by even referring to them as technology, because they're really not. They're just like, they're behaviorist experiments, you know, from 80 years ago, just run at very high speeds thanks to the speed of light. They're not, like, there's nothing particularly complicated about how Facebook runs or about how Twitter runs or about how Instagram or TikTok runs. It's really very simple stuff. Like, it's not high tech. It's actually really, it's kind of low tech. It's just fast. And in a way, it's not technology at all. I mean, at least not in the sense that we were raised to think about technology, like technology as something which enables us to do things we couldn't do before. So, like, you know, so part of this book is about, you know, growing up in Southwestern Ohio in the 1970s and 1980s. And in various ways, my life was connected, as so many other people's were, to inventions from the state or from that part of the state, and technologies which enabled us to do things we couldn't do before, to move faster, for example. The social media isn't like that. I mean, sure, if people use it the correct way, they can learn things they wouldn't have learned otherwise. But basically, it's not designed to make us more capable. It's designed to make us less capable. It appeals to the parts of us which we share with other animals. It appeals to our fear or anxiety. It appeals to our conformism. And this isn't the bug. This is the feature. This is how it's supposed to be. The bug is actually that occasionally people learn things. That's the bug. That's not really supposed to happen. The feature is that we are drawn in by a deliberate algorithmic appeal to our fears and to our conformism. And since we spend so much time with this stuff, it ends up shaping the way that we see other people, see ourselves, see the world. And I'm afraid almost none of it is good. I mean, since, you know, people try to figure out what's gone wrong since with democracy in the last 15 years, I mean, and answer number one is social media. Mm-hmm. If we're not spending time with each other, then we can't really be involved in democratic politics. And if we're being trained, essentially, if we're being herded, if we're being taught that the way to be in politics is to only do the stuff which you yourself happen to feel good about, then, you know, that leads us away from the kind of reason and compromise that you need for the systems that we say that we prize.
The way to be free is to engage with other people and to develop rationales based upon our interactions with other people, to read real physical books that we can hold in our hands, to have genuine conversations where we're looking in the other person's eyes. This doesn't happen on social media.
That is all, every word of that, you know, every word of that in gold leaf. It's all exactly, it's so true. Books are very liberating because if you're with a physical book, you're in the presence of another mind. You know, a mind that was committed to actually writing something from the beginning to the end, to hold a thought or to develop a plot. When you're reading a book, you're with another mind, and you're with another mind that's at its best. And there's a kind of miracle of being with a mind of a person who's not actually present, who may well not be alive at any point. That's the miracle of books. In that sense, a book is a far superior technology to social media. It does things that social media simply cannot do under any incarnation. And of course, about the humans, I mean, what social media does is that it picks up on our human abilities to interact, but it draws that in an inhuman direction. And it draws us towards the most basic neurological functions of fight or flight. And of course, sometimes that's appropriate. It's just not appropriate when you're looking at a screen. And what it can't supply is that corporeal feeling, that comfort, the certain kind of understanding that we have when we're in the presence of a creature, which is like ourselves, another human being. And not least for freedom, you know, other people can help us to be better, but they can also, to return to the point about empathy, like they can also teach us what we've got wrong, which social media never do. No one on social media ever writes, "Oh yes, I've been convinced by your argument." That never happens. We have quadrillions of interactions in, you know, every hour, and no one ever says that. Whereas when you're listening to another person, at least there's a chance that you're going to get it, that you're going to learn something about yourself that you didn't know before. At least there's that chance.
That reminded me of another theme in your book. And by the way, when I was reading your book, I felt that way that you describe, where I'm engaging with the material and it's improving my thinking and my understanding and making me more free. And I appreciated that deeply.
Thank you.
We have the body. You alluded to it a moment ago. We have the body and two different ways to look at it.
Yeah, that's a deep question. It's one of the things that I try to do in the book is that I try to take familiar things and make them unfamiliar. And I do that sometimes by using words from philosophers who wrote in other languages. And so in English, we can only really say body. But in German, there are two different words. One of them is Körper and the other one is Leib. And Körper means body. In most of the senses, we use body, like it means the human body, but it also means an astral body or any kind of body, any sort of thing which is subject to laws of physics. Whereas there's this nice word Leib, which is a little archaic at this point, which means an animal's body or a body of a creature in a story or a human body. And the thing that Leib is trying to get across is that a human body, although of course it obeys the laws of physics, it also does other things. It's lively. It makes contact with other creatures. It's not only in this world of three dimensions and physical regularities. It's also in another world. It's living. It's living in the fourth dimension. It's concerned with things in yet another dimension, which in the book I call the fifth. It's concerned with what's good or what's right. It's concerned with tastes and principles and values. And that's, you know, we can kind of be one or we can kind of be the other, you know, and the social media tend to drive us towards a more predictable state where we're behaving more like just physical bodies. Whereas I think when we're free, we're more unpredictable because the combinations of values that we have, especially when you put those values into interaction with the values of other people, that leads us off to unpredictable places, which are not the same as what a physical law would predict and which cannot even be predicted by algorithms. And that's good. Like, that's sound. That's what freedom is all about. But it does come down to the body. I mean, I'm trying to be very basic about this. I think that the way that we think about philosophy and freedom has tended to lead us towards the predicaments we're in, because we tend not to think about the body at all. We tend to imagine freedom in terms of somebody who already has complete health, and you know they're not thinking about being born or dying. They're making so-called rational choices among commodities and so forth. It's already this very abstract individual who is really kind of bodiless. But in fact, if we're going to have a free country or a free society, or better, a land of the free, because you can't really have a free country, you can only have free people. The way to have free people is to think about birth and to think about all the relationships that begin from birth forward and imagine what those relationships would have to be so that any given American child is going to have a chance to be free. I think if we start from that, like that kind of irreducible, undeniable fact that we all start the same way as bodies and that we move through time as bodies, then I think we end up with a much sounder, richer, more tenable, more politically helpful version of freedom than if we do what we usually do, which is to say, okay, I'm just going to imagine a kind of abstract creature who's fighting against some kind of enemy and he's fighting for freedom. That doesn't really do it.
It's the Book Nook. I've been joined by Professor Timothy Snyder. We're talking about his new book on freedom. And he grew up in our area, and he will be back in our area later this week. And he does have some events planned. And you can meet him. He will be here at various locations, including Joseph Beth Booksellers in Cincinnati, 7 o'clock on the evening of Thursday, October 17th. That's 2682 Madison Road for a signing and a talk. And then a big event at the Murphy Theater in Wilmington, Friday, October 18th, is the ticketed event. That's 50 West Main Street, themurphytheater.org for ticket information. A lot of information there on the website about this particular event at the Murphy Theater, Friday, October 18th at 7 o'clock. And then on Sunday, he will be in Columbus area at the Bexley Public Library, 2411 East Main Street. That's 3 o'clock that afternoon. And those are his events coming up, and we'll continue our conversation right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. We did our first author interview in October 1994, 30 years of the Book Nook. My guest today is Professor Timothy Snyder. Before the break, we were talking about the babies. We have to begin with the infants. We can't just suddenly become free at the age of 21.
Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, it's such a basic point, but no one ever makes it, you know? Like, the book rests a lot, of course, on the research of other people, and some of the research that it rests on is in the very important field of childhood development. And we know, it's a bit like climate change, like we know a lot. We don't necessarily apply it, but we know a lot about the first 5 years of life. And we've got a pretty robust sense of the kinds of things that children should have. You know, they need time, above all, they need time from us. They need time from older people in order to develop the faculties which we know, connecting it to freedom, you're going to need to become free. If you're going to be free, you can't just be a slave to your impulses. You can't be fooled by everybody else all the time. You have to have developed the ability to know what your emotions are. You have to have some practice in dealing with other people. You have to have some confidence in your ability to handle objects in the outside world and so on. And all these things go back to childhood. And childhood, of course, how childhood goes depends a lot on what kind of politics we have and what kind of institutions we have in place. Whether parents, to take a really simple example, can take time off to be with their kids, as they can in most democratic countries around the world. That is exactly where you have to begin. And I think our whole tradition, the whole English-speaking tradition, I mean, not the whole thing, there are exceptions. There are certainly feminist writers who I'm drawing on, and there are African-American critics who I'm drawing on who have paid attention to the body. I'm not trying to say that I made this all up, because I didn't. But our mainstream tradition, where we just kind of imagine an adult who already has kind of everything he needs, and I say he consciously because I think it is implicitly always a man, we imagine this like middle-aged man who has property, et cetera, has everything he needs. We imagine that, and then we think, well, freedom is just whether he likes this brand of that and that brand of this. That's not it. Freedom is how you get to the point where you have that adult who is capable of making choices, hopefully much more interesting choices than just, you know, the commodities.
My guest is Timothy Snyder, and Professor Snyder's new book is On Freedom. He joins us in the Book Nook today. Years ago, I had Studs Terkel on the show, and he said something that really stuck with me. I don't know if he was quoting somebody. I don't remember, but the line was, true patriotism is dissent. And you talk a lot about Vaclav Havel in this book, who I think of as one of the great dissenters. And didn't he say something like, the basic question is, do you prefer good beer or bad beer?
Yeah. See, this is the thing. The people, so Havel himself said something about dissent, he was trying to take the glamour away from the idea of dissent. He didn't want us to think that there was this like big bad communist regime, and then there were the heroic dissenters who were charging it with their lances or whatever. What he wanted us to see is that freedom begins with being who you are, who you really are. Like, that's the important thing. And like, beer is a great example. Like, do you like good beer? You know, do you really care? Maybe you're a poser. Maybe you're pretending. But maybe you really do care. Havel wrote, you know, he wrote this famous essay called Power of the Powerless, in which one of his examples was good beer. And that's what freedom is. Like, it's not, there are extreme moments where people have to resist, like in Ukraine today. But for the most part, freedom is just a little tiny bit of courage to be the person you really are and to find the other people who like the things you like and care about the things you care about and who want to build something, you know, whether it's a park or whether it's a microbrewery, whether it's a soccer club or, you know, whatever it is, like the things you really care about, which I think in America is one of the hardest things, you know, for people to actually admit what they actually care about. Mm-hmm. And so Havel was saying that like dissent is not charging against the communist regime. Dissent is just being honest about the things you love and then being willing to take the hit when it comes. And so when he went to prison, it was for a rock and roll band. That's what he went to prison for. He went to prison because of a rock and roll band. That's why. Because he thought that they represented the kind of freedom his country needed. And he took their side, and so he went to prison for that. Not for some glorious ideal of freedom, but because he thought those rock musicians, the Plastic People of the Universe, and several other bands actually, that they were living their lives in a free way. Like, it's the little things that make you free. And so that's the idea of freedom that I'm starting from. You know, it's like it's being true, it's being authentic, it's having friends, it's forming groups, that sort of thing. And then what's wrong with government is when government stops you from doing that, as in communist Czechoslovakia. But what's right with government is when government helps you to do that. Like if you have music class in school, you're more likely to be a rock and roll musician. If you have chemistry class, you're going to be a better microbrewer. If there are roads in your town, you know, you're going to be able to drive your bus to your next tour stop or whatever. But government is there so that we can become those kinds of people. That's kind of the point.
My guest has been Professor Timothy Snyder. His new book is On Freedom. Before I let you go, I have just one more thing kind of off topic I wanted to ask you about. I know your book is partly a memoir, and you talk about how you loved going to Cincinnati Reds games. You talk about how Joe Morgan was such a great player. You played baseball. You were a pitcher. And with the death of Pete Rose this week, who once was quoted as saying, "I'd walk through hell in a gasoline suit to play baseball." Do you have any mm-hmm. thoughts or memories about him?
Yeah, I mean, I sure do. Of course I do. I mean, I love that team. And that was a very special team, the Big Red Machine of the 1970s. Like, I grew up with that as though it were normal. You know, those are the games I listened to on the radio all summer long, you know, at home or in my grandparents' houses. And you know, that was when I played baseball with a friend. You know, I would go through that lineup, which I can still do by heart, and pretend to be each one of those players. And each one of them had something very special. You know, every last one of those starters, those eight starters, had something special about him. And Joe Morgan's one who figures in my book because Joe Morgan was my favorite player. I think he probably was the best player of his time. But I'll tell you about Pete Rose. I mean, Pete Rose always paid attention. He always knew when he could stretch a single into a double. He never stopped paying attention. He always hustled. He didn't care if people made fun of him for trying really hard, which is a really important thing. You know, he wasn't the greatest natural athlete, but he tried really hard all the time, and he didn't mind, you know, that not everybody did that. And he got those 200 hits, and he batted 300, you know, pretty much every year. But there was a phrase that, you know, I guess people probably still use it, but people used it a lot in the 70s, about playing the game the right way. You know, so I'm not saying that Pete Rose was a great person off the field. You know, we all have things that we do which we shouldn't have done. But he certainly played the game the right way. He respected the rules of the game, and he played the game the right way. He did the right things. He took the rules of the game, and he made those rules work for him. And that, by the way, connects to freedom. You know, like sports do figure in this book, not just the Reds in baseball, but kind of sports in general, because sports are an example of how, you know, there are rules, right? Like if you throw a ball, there are physical rules. There's gravity. Every time you throw, you're in a dance with gravity. Every time you pitch, you're in a relationship with gravity. Every time you run, for that matter. And then you can't break the rules of the game either, but you can make them work for you. And I think that's a better assessment of what, you know, freedom is like. You're not free as a baseball player if you try to run through the wall, right? But you are free as a baseball player if you know where the wall is and you can make a spectacular catch. Mm. You're not free as a baseball player like if you don't run down the first base line. You are free if you know how to get a quick first step out of the batter's box. And so things like that can help us. I mean, everyday things like that can help us think about the big ideas too. So anyway, thanks for the chance.
I love that comparison. My guest has been Professor Timothy Snyder. The book is On Freedom. Thank you so much for your time today.
Very glad to be with you.
My guest has been Professor Timothy Snyder. His new book is On Freedom, and he will be in our area this week. You can meet him. You can hear him speak. You could probably even get him to sign your book if you have one. And these events are Thursday, October 17th. He'll be at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Cincinnati, 2682 Madison Road, 7 p.m. And then a ticketed event at the Murphy Theater in Wilmington, 7 p.m. Friday, October 18th. That's 50 West Main Street. For information, themurphytheater.org. And on Sunday afternoon, October 20th, he'll be in the Columbus area at the Bexley Public Library, 3 o'clock that afternoon. So there you have it. He's swinging through Ohio. He's got a number of events. He'll be up in northern Ohio as well, but those are the ones in proximity to our broadcast area. And this is quite a book. I want to read you a little excerpt from it. This is from something he calls Lake and Forest. It is easy to espouse one value or to disavow them all. Believing is just one thing, like believing in nothing at all. It enables us to scorn other people and reject their values. And this is very satisfying. But freedom is not scorn and rejection. It is choice and affirmation. It is not a shove off a cliff, but a climb up a mountain. Negative freedom objectifies. Positive freedom, true freedom, humanizes. Freedom is hard. So we are tempted by simple algorithms that stand in for thinking and keep us from acting. The simplest is to defer any evaluation and to stay clear of the world of values. Let someone else make decisions for us. Let God tell us what is right. Let the members of the Politburo or the prophets of the free market tell us what is right. Let the leader, the tribe, the television, the internet tell us what is right. Ideology produces algorithms of helplessness for us. Scientific socialism placed responsibility elsewhere. Does something seem to be going terribly wrong? Has your agricultural policy starved millions of people? Did your alliance with Hitler proceed and enable the invasion of your country by Nazi Germany? That was just the price of progress. And there was no alternative. Faith in the free market functions much the same way, sometimes exactly the same way. Financial markets have collapsed. Monopolies have coalesced. The billionaires have collected all the new wealth generated in your country since the day you were born. Birth pangs of a new age. There is nothing you can do. The special American national algorithm is the false tragedy of choice. This conviction leads us to constrict the world of values and make ourselves less free. It has cut lanes so deep into common sense that it takes work even to see it. The false tragedy begins with the acceptance that choices must be made between values. So far, so good. But rather than encouraging you to realize as many values as you can, the false tragedy demands a final disposition whenever tension between values appears. In making a choice now, you must nullify forever the value you cannot realize. After the unchosen value has been banished, you are to be congratulated on your hard-headed realism, manly nod, downturn lips, and so the realm of values shrinks, as does the range of future choices. If we think that opting for one value means obliterating another, we retreat step by step from the borderland of the unpredictable. Rather than using our minds to seek ever new combinations or ever new values, we persuade ourselves that the easy answer was correct, that only one value really matters. As we concede our right to practice and choose, we try to persuade others to do the same. Freedom then winds down. Timothy Snyder, from his new book, On Freedom. And at the end of my conversation with Professor Snyder, we went off topic, and we talked about Pete Rose. And I loved his observations about Pete Rose and how he was able to bring it back to the subject of freedom. And I'm going to bring it back to the subject of Pete Rose, because next Saturday, 1 week from today, we'll bring you the best of the book. Now, we have a special interview for you. I'll bring you an interview we did in April with a guy who wrote a new biography of Pete Rose. It's called Charlie Hustle. Keith O'Brien wrote it. We're going to bring you some excerpts from that interview talking about the tragedy of Pete Rose and what an amazing baseball player he was. And then, to close out that program on Saturday, we're going to bring you an excerpt from an interview I did with the man himself 5 years ago, the late, great Pete Rose. Recorded in 2019, he'd written a memoir called Play Hungry. And Pete liked to observe that he's probably written more books than he's read, and I love that quote from him. And speaking of guys who should be in the Hall of Fame, this week I was saddened to hear that one of my favorite pitchers of all time died. He died on October 8th in Maine. They called him El Tiante, Louis Tiant, another guy who should be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion. Maybe now that he's not with us anymore, they'll put him in there. The guy had an amazing pitching career. He pitched for 19 years. His main teams were the Cleveland Indians and the Boston Red Sox. His record was 229 and 172. He pitched 3,486 and a third innings. He struck out 2,416 batters. His lifetime ERA over that period was 3.30. He pitched 187 complete games, including 49 shutouts. He won 20 games four different times. He's an amazing guy. He was an amazing guy. In 1959, he got his first contract to play baseball, and he split the season between the Havana Sugar Kings in his native Cuba and the Mexico City Tigers. They paid him $150 a month. What an amazing guy. On July 19th, 1964, he made his debut as a major league pitcher, pitching for the Cleveland Indians. He had a 3-0 shutout of the New York Yankees at Yankee Stadium. They were the defending champions, and he defeated the Yankee ace, Whitey Ford, in that particular contest. The Yankees eked out just four singles in that shutout against El Tiante. In 1968, He had a 1.60 ERA, which was incredible. But he was overshadowed by the fact that that same year in the National League, St. Louis Cardinal pitcher Bob Gibson had an even lower ERA of 1.12. And as you baseball fans will recall, that's when they decided they had to change the height of the mound so these guys, these pitchers, didn't have such an advantage over the hitters. In 1968, El Tiante had a 1.60 ERA. He pitched 9 shutouts. There are only 2 pitchers who have had more than 4 shutouts in a row in their careers besides El Tiante, Bob Gibson, and Don Drysdale. On July 3rd of 1968, he struck out 19 Minnesota Twins in 10 innings, which was the major league record, as you'll recall, until just some years ago. And that year, he had the lowest earned run average since Walter Johnson of the Washington Senators 50 years before in 1919. Of course, Bob Gibson had that lower ERA, but Bob Gibson is in the Hall of Fame. El Tiante is not, and I think he should be. And we also have big news out of Cincinnati. Terry Francona has been named the manager. He retired ostensibly a year ago from the Cleveland Indians. Well, I should say the Cleveland Guardians. And he was having some health issues, but apparently the Cincinnati Reds have lured him out of retirement to coach them next year. And I'll never forget the first time I ever saw Terry Francona. This was years ago. I went to a Cincinnati Reds game with a couple of my old pals, the late Bill Hooper and Perry Stewart from Yellow Springs. And Perry got his tickets right behind the visitor's dugout. They were playing the Phillies, and their young manager kept popping out of the dugout, talking to his guys, and it was Terry Francona. He went on to win the World Series, the first one in 86 years, managing the Red Sox. And he's a great manager, and I wish him well with the Cincinnati Reds because they certainly need help, and they need something to spark them. They finally made their manager pay the price and scapegoated him and blamed him for their failures, as so often happens in baseball. And it's just amazing. Okay, so we've covered our baseball here. We've got Pete Rose coming up next Saturday. We'll be honoring him and remembering Pete Rose, a troubled man, but a great baseball player, who, as I mentioned a little earlier, was once quoted as saying, "I'd walk through hell in a gasoline suit to play baseball." And the man had a passion for the game. In that interview I did with him, he talked about what made the difference, what turned him into a hitter, the hitter he became. And that was winter ball in Caracas, Venezuela. He went down there, and he raised his anemic batting average. And from then on, it was 200 hits a year, every year, until one year when he was injured. He just kept racking up the hits and ended up getting more hits than any other player in baseball history. He passed Ty Cobb by a long stretch. What an amazing guy. But unfortunately, he had a demon. He couldn't stop gambling. And then when they caught him, he couldn't admit that he gambled on baseball. And then he lived in shame and infamy for the rest of his life. And I know that this is unlikely. I know they have rules and regulations in baseball, but it sure would be nice if they cut him a break here now that he's no longer with us. Because I think the guy deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Along with Louis Tiant, who was up for election on a number of occasions but didn't get enough votes. El Tiante. So that's next Saturday in the Book Nook. We'll be honoring Pete Rose at 7 a.m. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. I hope you're enjoying the end of the baseball season and maybe some upsets. Thanks for listening. This is your public radio station, WYSO.